Peter Kosminski is a local boy. Funnily enough, I was in Neil Ferguson's talk and he said that no history has ever happened in Wiltshire. And Peter and I are shocked by that because we know that he's wrong. But these academics, they sometimes, you know, say things that they'll regret later. I don't really need to introduce Peter. He's an amazing film and television director, producer, and writer. And I'm sure that Claire will take you through his glittering career, and we will all be fascinated by that. I asked if he was going to be signing his book after. He said, I haven't written a book. So we'll have him back next year when he has. Peter Kosminski.
Hello, everybody. It's lovely to see so many people here. I hope you're all okay, heat-wise. Hopefully, it will get a bit cooler as the hour goes on. So my name is Claire Langhammer. I'm the director of the Institute of Historical Research, which is based in Senate House in London, and a historian of modern Britain at the University of London. It's an absolute privilege to be having this conversation with Peter. Peter's career is marked by a commitment to telling stories that matter. To engage with his work is to engage with some of the most powerfully agenda-setting television of the last four decades. His achievements include The Falklands War, The Untold Story, Shoot to Kill, No Child of Mine, Warriors, The Project, The Government Inspector, Brits, The Promise, and of course, the masterpiece that is Wolf Hall. His work has received widespread acclaim and very many awards, but perhaps more importantly, he remains committed to work that tells overlooked or hidden stories and that challenges abuses of power whilst tenaciously seeking out the truth. His work is founded upon meticulous attention to detail and has a strong ethical core. It also, as we'll be talking about tonight, makes rigorous use of all of the available evidence. So, Peter, thinking about with your work over the last few weeks, I've been really struck by how historical it is. Nearly all of your work seems to reflect on moments or events of deep historical significance. And there's just a structure, a profound historical sensibility to it, even when you're dramatizing the very recent past. So I think what we're going to do in the hour that we have, we will have some time for questions, we'll have a quarter of an hour's question time, is to really dig into your practice, to think really about how you do your work more than what you work on. But before we talk about some of your particular projects over your incredibly impressive career, I want to start with the why question. Why television and why drama documentary in particular?
Okay. Well, first of all, hello, everyone. Thank you for coming out in ludicrously large numbers on such a hot day. It's really nice to see you. I studied chemistry at university, which is not an obvious route in for. I was quite a perverse young man, really. So, you know, I was studying chemistry, wasn't very interested in it, really. So I spent a lot of time in the student theatre, and I thought it would be a bit of a laugh to apply to the BBC because, you know, no one like me would ever get in from a very sort of ordinary background, not posh at all, hadn't gone to a posh school, wasn't very rich, and wasn't studying English literature or classics. Yeah. But for some bizarre reason, the BBC let me in, and that's how I got into television.
And how about drama documentary in particular? And we'll pick up some of your documentary work in a bit. But what is it about drama documentary that allows you to tell the stories that you want to tell?
That's a good question, really. But first of all, you know, I will make a joke about my scientific background. There's a sort of research rigor to all of that. that was sort of dug deeply into me, really. And then you sort of get to a situation where you're working in a different medium, but the instincts are still the same. You want to research something and find a new way of telling that story. I made documentaries for about 10 years, and the truth is nobody watched them, really. I mean, there are two possible explanations for that. One is that they were rubbish, undoubtedly true, and the other one was that they were documentaries, and by their nature, they tend to be scheduled late at night on minority channels. And, you know, there'd be years of work in some of them, research and filming. So I thought, well, drama, you know, that goes on the main channel at 9 o'clock. Yeah. Lots of people watch it. Let's see if we can be a bit subversive and slip some of these serious subjects in under the essentially the same genre that does cop shows. Yeah. So that was the thinking. It was no more sophisticated than that.
I love that. We'll come back to thinking about the challenges of the opportunities that drama presents for presenting rigorously research material. But for now, let's go back to that kind of 10-year period when you were doing documentaries. Because, I recently watched the Falklands War documentary made in 1987, just 5 years after the war. And I don't know how many people in the audience have seen it, but if you haven't, oh my goodness, you must see it. I mean, it is the most incredible documentary. It's kind of emotional, but not mawkish. It's poetic, but it doesn't hide the horror of war. I mean, it's as a piece of filmmaking, it's quite extraordinary. And part of that is the research, which is so evident in it. And I wondered if you could just talk us through the process of putting that documentary together and the kind of the work underneath the sea, if you like, the iceberg, of what happened, how you got to make that piece.
Sure. Well, as you say, it was made in the mid-1980s, and the television world was a very different place from the one we enjoy today. I had a team of 6 researchers. The idea that a documentary could have 6 researchers now is laughable. Mm. You're lucky if you have 1. And we worked on it researched it for about 18 months before we even started filming. I should just explain that the premise was to tell the story through the words of people directly involved on both sides of the conflict. So you'll remember this was a very short war between the British Army, a British forces who traveled down in a task force, and the Argentinian regular army who were occupying the Falklands Islands at that point. So we managed to track down combatants on both sides, pilots, marines, naval officers and ratings on both sides. So, for example, we were talking to people who were on HMS Ardent, and we found the Argentine pilot who had dropped the bomb that set fire to Ardent and caused everyone to have to evacuate. And intercutting those two stories was powerful. Another of our researchers was just looking for unseen library footage. And some of this was amateur video.
Yeah.
Photographs that the combatants had taken privately for their own use that they were prepared to share with us. So it was a particular, you know, it wasn't full of politicians. It didn't have lots of commentary telling you what to think. It was, the story was told through the voices of those involved, and some of the things they said were profoundly moving.
Yeah.
So you do what you always do. You research it thoroughly. You go and meet a lot of people. You try to figure out who would be compelling on camera. You shoot a lot of stuff and you cut together the best bits. Yeah. That was broadly it, really.
I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to watch. I was really struck by the amateur film, actually, particularly that the film of the task force going down, and that which really underpinned that sense that nobody was really expecting to fight, and the kind of playfulness.
The deck games they were playing. Yes.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I mean, you said, is there a book to sign? There isn't a book to sign now, but there was a book related to the programme, wasn't there?
We did produce, one of my colleagues and I produced a book based on the transcripts of the interviews we carried out. Yes, the only time I've ever done it, actually.
Yeah. How did you find that process?
Confusing, because the raw material of the interview is not really intended to be given a wider audience. We shoot that material with a specific aim in mind, which is to find the sections that will work on their own and in juxtaposition to what other people are saying and what imagery we have available. The raw material is it's a bit like putting together a wedding video and including all the bits you wish you hadn't included. You know, similar feeling to that, really.
Yeah. It's really interesting because actually your process is very much the process of any historian. You know, going out there, finding all of the available material, weighing it, and then putting it into a narrative in a way that isn't heavy-handed, in a way that sometimes allows the material to speak for itself. Do you ever get approaches from historians who would like to get at your raw material?
Yes. In fact, I received one this morning. But we don't share it because the material was given to us for a very specific function. That's all we have permission to use it for. So generally, I don't write books. Generally, I don't share the transcripts of the research we've done with academics, even decades later, because it breaks the trust with the people who've given us access to that. And some of this material is deeply personal, you know. So there's a custodianship issue, actually.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, if you're a highly respected academic historian, Claire, this is probably like, what? This is a vital historical document. But if you assemble material on one understanding, you must honour that.
No, and I think there's an ethics of care for all historians about the material, you know, whether you're dealing with living people who've done oral history interviews for you, or whether you're dealing with the lives of people who died centuries ago. I think that carefulness about what you do with their lives, and that extends to the permissions that they've given you about how you should use it. Mm-hmm. Can I take you forward then to another conflict, the war in Bosnia, that you then did do a drama documentary about? Can I ask you to think about how different the experience of doing the research for the documentary and the drama documentary was? This was Warriors, which I think was released in 1999, wasn't it? So not long after the conflict itself again.
It was a 2-hour drama on BBC One about British peacekeepers trying to keep the peace in Bosnia in 1992-93, and it was based on an operation called Grapple One. Mm-hmm. And the military retirees here in the audience will know what I'm talking about. And specifically the experience of the Cheshire Regiment had a pretty tough time out there. What's the main difference? Because there are huge similarities when you assemble the material. It's essentially researchers trying to persuade people, and sometimes me, trying to persuade people to talk to you, to trust you, and to open up sometimes emotionally about what they've experienced. The primary difference is that in a drama, they don't have to appear on television.
Yeah.
So when you're talking to somebody for a documentary, they can tell you all kinds of extraordinary things. But if they're not prepared to appear on camera, you've got nothing. With a drama, it's the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Often the main argument you can deploy for why people might be prepared to talk to you is that they don't need to appear on camera and that you will never reveal who spoke to you. So when you're an audience member and you sit and you watch Warriors or Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, it's an interesting example you choose, Claire, the iceberg. You just see the finished program, and it may have taken 5, 6, 7 years to make. And all you see is those, two or three hours or whatever it is, finished. You get no sense at all of the years of research and process. And the people who have spoken to you under conditions of anonymity to... And of course, drama being drama, you also have a suspicion that it's all made up. So we have to caption our shows really carefully so people know what they're watching. If it's a true story, say it's a true story. If it's based on a true story, that means there's an additional level of fictionalization. If it's inspired by a true story, it means you're making it up.
Right. Okay, that's good. It's interesting, that sense that there is so much research that goes into, years of research that goes into this work, because the comparison would be academics who, as you well know, are always perhaps overly keen to show their workings and to footnote everything and to provide every single example that they've ever found in an archive. So I think perhaps academics could learn something from you and not always having to show everything.
Well, my most direct personal encounter with that was on Wolf Hall and working with Hilary Mantel. Because, it's hardly the first drama about King Henry VIII that we've seen on television. In fact, my first was The Six Wives of Henry VIII, starring Keith Michelle, when I was a child. But what did Hilary do? Hilary spent 5 years researching this material. And if you talk to respected historians of the period, like Dermot McCulloch, he will tell you that her research was impeccable. And then she wrote the novels, the three novels. Now she, as you rightly say, doesn't footnote her material. You read it and you think, that can't be true. And you just have to, I suppose you have to trust that she would not set out to mislead you. And that's the watchword that I've used throughout my career in television. That in the end, it's a bond of trust between us as program makers and the audience that we will not mislead. Because make no mistake, it's a powerful medium. I can mislead you if I want to. I can mislead you in a documentary by choosing bits of interview, putting pejorative narration next to them, and using emotive music. I can mislead you in a drama, because as you say, you don't know what the sources are. In the end, the audience is relying on the integrity of the program maker. Now, of course, we have lawyers who check this kind of thing in the background, but they're busy people and there's a lot of material.
Yeah.
They're looking at the headline stuff. Who's going to sue us for defamation if this goes out like this? So I can mislead you if I want to. The point is, I don't want to.
Yeah.
What's the point of telling a story if you're just going to make up the key bits to make it overly dramatic? My job is to make it watchable without misleading.
I mean, that's such a tricky relationship to you know, or things to juggle, isn't it? Because the entertaining, if you've never been tempted to kind of over-egg it and just take it a little bit too far in ways that you've regretted subsequently?
Not tempted, but I have, unintentionally.
Right.
It may have been an excess of hubris, but I will describe it, the incident. So I don't know if anyone here remembers a drama that we made quite a few years ago, actually the first time I worked with Mark Rylance,
yes,
called The Government Inspector. It was about the events leading up to the death of the government weapons inspector, Dr. David Kelly, who you may remember committed suicide in a little wood in Oxfordshire, near his home. And he was driven, if indeed he was, to those events, to that situation, because of a fight that developed between Alistair Campbell and the New Labour government on the one hand, and BBC News on the other. And in particular, a journalist called Andrew Gilligan, who had joined the Today programme from, I think, from memory, the Daily Telegraph, and was and broadcast something in which he said that a source had told him that the government had sexed up its arms dossier, which was a key stepping point. In other words, it had made the evidence seem more compelling than it actually was. And this was a key building block in the process of us going to war against Iraq. So it was a serious issue. And David Kelly ended up being outed as a result of that and committed suicide shortly afterwards. And we told that story. So the thing that I was most proud about in that film was that by going through with a computer forensic scientist, some of the documents that Andrew Gilligan, the journalist, had given up, which related to the little sharp organizer that he'd used to make his notes of his conversation with David Kelly, his confidential source. We were able to show that he had changed those notes subsequent to Kelly's death. So they appeared to be contemporaneous notes, but in fact, in part, at least, they were not.
Mm.
That was a pretty devastating thing. First of all, because it had never been revealed before. It's very rare that drama reveals something new because of our long gestation process. But secondly, given what happened subsequently, if you think that the chairman and the director general of the BBC were forced to resign, David Kelly lost his job and eventually his life. And the relationship between the BBC and the Labour Party was poisoned for many years. So this was a serious matter.
Yeah.
And if it was true that the notes on which the Andrew Gilligan's broadcast was based were a little shaky, shall we say, then that was a matter of serious. So we dramatized this, got it past the lawyers, showed them the research. They were persuaded. We included in the drama, and I waited for the coverage. And coverage came, but it wasn't of that. I'd had another scene, just an inconsequential scene, where Tony Blair, the actor playing Tony Blair, was talking to the actor playing Alistair Campbell late at night on the phone, and Campbell was trying to persuade Blair of something. Blair didn't want to do it, so he was deflecting and prevaricating by playing his guitar. You know, used to be in a band, playing his electric guitar, strumming away, and we dramatized. It was rather fun. Alistair Campbell's like on the end of the phone going mad because he wants Blair to focus on this, and Blair's rather cleverly trying to avoid making a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know what they said to each other because it all came out in the public inquiry. And we know that from another source that Tony Blair liked to play his guitar late at night, and it sort of helped him think sometimes. But what we don't know is that Tony Blair was playing his guitar at that moment. And that kind of sunk us, really, if I'm honest, because the one thing I've learned over the years making controversial dramas is the people who are on the receiving end of it will put up a smoke screen. They'll find something to distract from the point that they don't want the audience to think about. So a smoke screen went up, and I made this, it was a mistake. It was a mistake because it handed a gift to people who didn't want the film, the drama, to be taken seriously. It was a small matter, you know, that obviously you dramatize things, you don't know what color the wallpaper was, you know, you make your best guess. But it was such an easy target. And I regret it to this day. It was a stupid mistake. I shouldn't have done it. I thought, well, that will be dramatic. It's exactly what I've just been talking about to you not doing. And I did it, and I've never forgotten it, and it distracted attention from the most important thing that was in the drama, which virtually no one now remembers.
Well, I mean, I think one of the most beautiful things about that particular drama is the way in which, and you do this elsewhere, I mean, in some ways it's what Wolf Hall is about, taking an individual life or the life of a group of friends as you do in the project and really kind of, you know, having that intimacy and encouraging the audience to have an intimacy with them and then spinning this massive story around them so that you're moving, you're using scale in really interesting ways. And I kind of wondered in thinking about the government inspector, but also thinking about Wolf Hall as well, how much of that is using emotion to pull the viewer in? And how do you think about emotion within your work?
Good question. Why is drama powerful? Why is it compelling when it is, which it isn't always, obviously? I think it's powerful and compelling because of that sense of there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Right.
You're watching somebody who you have nothing in common with, nothing, perhaps, a British soldier trying to keep the peace in Bosnia, or a courtier in the court of Henry VIII in the 16th century. But as soon as if it's well written and it's beautifully acted, you suddenly see the emotional reaction to situations, and that you can associate with. You may not know what it's like to be Thomas Cromwell, but you know what it's like to feel the way he does when Henry VIII attacks him publicly. You can feel that same sense of wanting the floor to open up and disappear beneath it. And that's, I think, why drama is compelling, and that's why I try to tell stories through the experience, usually, if at all possible, of an ordinary person. When I do dramas about things, you mentioned the project, which was about New Labour again, and we didn't really dramatise, in that case, the people at the top of the party. We told the story through the experience of just a group of young activists and what happened to them through that period of opposition and then government, because they're closer to the audience. And you know what happens in drama, you take a young man, let's say, or woman, let's say they're 19 years old, not that much experience of life, and you throw them into the crucible of war or conflict or some kind of experience that's utterly remote from them.
Yeah.
And they come out changed.
Yeah.
And you hear this, you know, oh, he came back from the war and we didn't recognize him. He was like a different person. Well, there's a reason people saying that, because there's been a cathartic experience there. And if you tell that story for the audience, they sort of go on the same journey with the character. So if you think about the Falklands War, the untold story, there was one character, Sergeant Lou Armour. He was a Marine, and he'd been part of the group of soldiers that were permanently stationed at Government House in Stanley on the Falklands. He was captured, sent back to Britain through Chile as a prisoner of war, came back down on the QE2, fought in the recapture of the Falklands, and saw the whole journey. You know, that's a story that an audience can follow, really. It's just an ordinary guy who went through that experience.
I think that pulling of the audience into their journey, into their to the way in which they change. I mean, the project is devastating, you know, to watch, because you see this, the tensions that we all encounter between pragmatism, ethics, and morality, you know, loom large. You know, is it best to do this slightly bad thing in order to make a better thing happen? But that transformation is so there in The Promise. And I once wondered if we could talk a little bit about The Promise, which, you know, is perhaps your most explicitly historical piece of work. It starts with a diary. And, you know, a diary is the spine of it, really. It's the mechanism through which you move us from the past into the present, across generations, in a really beautiful way. So perhaps could you say a little bit more about that and the making of that?
Well, I think The Promise is probably the thing of which I'm most proud in 45 years of program making. It certainly got me into more trouble than anything else I've done. Just to explain, it's set in two time frames. The period 1945 to 1948, and essentially the present day, or what was the present day when we made the show about 15 years ago. And it tells the story of, in one time frame, of a young British soldier with no family. He was adopted as a child. He's fought his way through the Second World War. He's part of the British Army team that liberated Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, and now he finds himself on peacekeeping duties in what was then called Palestine. And as people may know, there was a massive insurgency, particularly amongst Jews living in Palestine who wanted their own state, and the British military who were stationed there. And remember, we had 100,000 people under arms there at that time. 100,000 people. That's larger than the entire British Army now. We're on the receiving end a lot of that violence. He writes a diary about his experiences. And in our other time frame, his diary is being read by his granddaughter, who happens to be going to Israel with a friend of hers for the summer holidays. And I was trying to, after many years of research, trying to draw parallels between what was happening in the two time frames. In Israel now, or 15 years ago, and in Palestine, which is geographically the same area, in 1945 to 48.
And the research process for that, I mean, you know, a diary is central to it. Were there other diaries that you looked at? I mean, what kind of material were you able to draw on?
Well, it's sad to say now, because we spoke to many, there's a thing called the Palestine Veterans Association.
Okay.
And the veterans of the Palestine police as well. We spoke to them. We spoke to many people who'd served out there in various capacities, British forces. Most of them, of course, are now dead. Very sad. They were very elderly when we spoke to them. And the experiences that Len, the soldier character, has are exclusively mined, really, from the experiences that these people describe to us and described in their letters home and their diaries, which they were, some of them were kind enough to make available to us. And this is what struck me when I knew that you, Claire, as a highly respected academic historian, were going to be interviewing me, which is one of the most terrifying things that's ever happened to me. That there is a real equivalence between, you know, those interviews that we did and all the other material, but particularly those interviews, are without question historical documents.
Yeah.
And they were given freely on certain undertakings, kind of which I alluded to earlier. So you're trying to craft the best drama, but you also, you know, that rule about not misleading, but also you feel a responsibility to these elderly guys, and they were guys in the main back then, who have trusted you with their story. And I met the families of some of these veterans, you know, and they said, do you realize he's never talked about this, ever? You know, the children growing up, we used to ask him and he would never talk about it. As far as we know, this is the first time he's ever talked about it to anyone. Mm-hmm. So we've got that material and I'm trying to make a drama that will work, but I'm also feeling an obligation and responsibility to the people who've trusted me, perhaps for the first time, to tell their story, not to let them down. And the single most nerve-wracking moment I ever have with a drama of this kind is when we show it to them. And we show it to them before the public sees it. And if they hate it, I want to slit my throat, really. I mean, seriously, it would be the worst thing. You know, you have custody of their story and you need to honour it.
It is a real responsibility. I think we play with people's lives at our peril. You know, we have to take that ethical responsibility as people working with the past very, 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 very seriously. We have to talk about Wolf Hall, I think, a little bit more. I wouldn't be forgiven if we didn't. And we've already touched on this a little bit. I'm very struck that historical fiction provides a way in for us to understand what it was like to live and to feel in a particular moment. And I suppose my first question around Wolf Hall is, did Hilary Mantel kind of give you advice on what you should be doing and how to render the books? Or did she just leave it up to you?
Well, picture the scene, okay? I'm going to try and evoke a truly terrifying moment for you. So I'm this guy who makes contemporary political drama docs or, you know, factually based drama.
This is a leap, isn't it, in some ways?
I get a phone call from this producer saying, would you like to come and do Wolf Hall? I think it's a wind-up. Well, why me? You know, yeah. I'm the least qualified person to do it. And of course, you know, the first two novels on which we based the first series, BBC series Wolf Hall, both separately won the Booker Prize. I'm not sure if that's ever happened before, maybe once. And then I have to go and meet this woman. Absolutely terrifying. So I went down to see her in Budleigh Salterton, where she lived. She couldn't have been more lovely. Her attitude was, I've done my bit. It's over to you now. I'll help you in any way you want. And she was so lovely that I thought, well, I just should be honest here. So I said, look, I'm really sorry, but I feel I'm here under false pretenses. I have no track record in this area. And she said, oh, yes, you do. When I was writing this, I always thought of it as like a contemporary drama. I always imagined it shot with handheld cameras, with the boom dropping into shot, sort of unintentionally from time to time. She said, that's what you do. And then the other piece of advice she gave me was, remember that these characters don't know they're in history.
Yeah.
Anne Boleyn doesn't know she's one of six, and she's going to be beheaded by a swordsman from Calais. Anne Boleyn was an extraordinary woman by all accounts, a political reformer. And she, you know, frankly, had she borne Henry a son, she probably would have seen out his reign.
Mm.
She had no idea that she what her fate was. She's living her life day to day, just like I am, just like you are. And what Hillary said, and it was, you know, the single most important note I received, was when you depict these people, depict them in the present. Don't depict them in some stuffy past. Remember that for them, they're in the present. And if you want to follow the philosophy that I was referring to earlier about telling the story through the direct experience of somebody with whom the audience might be able to associate, then, you know, the audience is living in the present, and so must those characters.
I think that, I mean, that's also a very useful, I think that's a useful piece of advice for anybody engaging with the past, that people are not self-consciously positioning themselves necessarily, they're just getting on with their everyday lives. And that takes me to the last thing I want to talk with you about, which takes you back to your documentary work. And this is a programme that you made in the 1980s called One Day in the Life of Television. Has anybody seen that in the audience? Again, it is the most gorgeous thing, and it is available to watch. It's a behind-the-scenes look at British television on the 1st of November 1988, and it takes you through the day in a just fabulous way. And I kind of wanted to ask you a little bit, finally, about how you made that, but also then because it really expresses a particular moment when television was made in a particular way and had a particular status within society. If you could just finish off by just saying a little bit about your sense of television today and where we are.
Okay, I'll try. How long have we got?
Briefly.
Not long.
Briefly.
Not long. Well, Day in the Life of Television, 40 film crews, 40 directors going out across the country to all the TV stations, all the regions, shooting what was happening on that one day. I did a couple of things, but there are a lot of other crews. But all the material, 200 hours of it, came back to me, and I had to condense 200 hours into 2 hours of television. Now, you know, I tend to shoot a lot, but even I don't normally have a ratio of 100 to 1. That was, and it took many months to go through it and structure it. And I was trying to make a point that television was changing and possibly changing for the worse. Pause for hollow laughter, because things have moved on a bit since then. Where are we now? Well, just very quickly, we're in the ship, basically. On one level, it's a wonderful time. Mm. You know, we have the streamers, and they make some great shows. And I love them. You know, I watch them. I love them. I don't have anything against the streamers. But they've pushed the price of everything we do, how much it costs to make a show, up to such an extent that our own homegrown broadcasters, BBC, ITV, Channel 4, what we call public service broadcasters, can't afford to make drama anymore. not like it's getting difficult. They actually can't afford. The only way Wolf Hall got made was by most of us who worked on it giving up most of our money. So that's fine. Maybe you say, okay, maybe the public service broadcaster's days are over and it's a different world now, except that there are kinds of programs that the streamers will never make, because everything they make has to play in America. And there are some shows that are quite important to people in this country, like Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, that they would never make. Because what's the post office if you live in Milwaukee? And it's those shows that BBC, ITV, and Channel 4 have a regulatory obligation to make, because they're regulated. So the streamers, not regulated, pay no tax, take your money, but have no obligation to make shows that might exclusively be of interest to a British audience. And that is the slightly uncomfortable situation we're in at the moment.
So the message is support public service broadcasting wherever we can, I think. And
way to do it, but that's a longer speech, and I don't want to cut into the audience's question.
Yeah, we're going to go to questions now. So if you want to raise your hand, and a microphone will miraculously appear in front of you, as it has there.
Good afternoon, Peter. I'd just like to say, as someone that doesn't watch a lot of television, I did watch all of Wolf Hall, and what you did was truly remarkable piece of television and drama. For it felt so real. So the question for both of you is, do you get frustrated when you see drama on television? For example, perhaps Ridley Scott's Napoleon, where the historical accuracy is perhaps not on script so much. Does that frustrate you both?
I mean, I would say, I think it's the thing that frustrates me is where it feels like the audience are being taken for fools. And I think that's a real problem. I think there is a place for, dramatizing. But I think this issue of not misleading, and I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. But over to you, Peter.
I agree. I think there's room for, my father's house has many mansions. There's room for lots of different things, as long as it's clear to the audience what it is they're seeing. There was a wonderful show on telly not that long ago. You probably didn't watch it because you don't watch much telly. Very sensible. Called The Tudors. And it was a romp. It was great fun. I don't think anyone thought it was what actually happened. And that Henry VIII was jumping in and out of bed with anything that moved in quite that way. But there's nothing wrong with that. But if it purports to be something that it isn't, or if, because they can't be bothered to explain what it is to the audience, people come away with the impression that even part of it is true when it isn't, that's seriously worrying. So from my point of view, it's trusting the audience to understand the process and to understand the nature of what they are seeing by telling them.
Thank you. We have a question here.
Hello, Peter. I absolutely adored Wolf Hall. I'm sure so many people in this room did. One of the scenes that I found so mesmerizing and haunting was that horrific execution scene of Anne Boleyn. And I'm sure I remember seeing you interviewed, I don't know if it was with Kirsty Walk, about doing that particular scene, but that must have been some experience for you and your crew and the actors involved. I'd just love to know, how you felt after putting that together, because it was done with so much tenderness, I thought.
Well, thank you. It means a hell of a lot to me to hear you say that. Thank you. Well, first of all, it's straight out of Hillary. That's the thing to say. We were just rendering her genius, really. But it was extraordinary, actually, because we shot the first series of Wolf Hall in high summer. And if you watch the exteriors, they're almost all in sunshine. In fact, the cast and crew used to swim in the moat of one of the castles we were filming at because we were all so hot. And we got to Dover Castle. Obviously, the tower has changed out of all recognition, so we couldn't use that. And the fog came in. The temperature dropped ridiculously, so we were all in padded coats, and the wind got up. And it made the most moody, threatening. I mean, it was the single biggest gift I could have been given on that show. And this was, for those who don't know, this was the end of episode 6 of the first series. And I'd like to say it was skill on my part, or even skill on the part of the actors, and it was to some extent. But it was actually the weather that was the star on that day.
I think serendipity as a research practice is much undervalued. We have a question here.
Thank you so much for your talk today. I want to ask you, when you come to the first read-through of a script, do you give an overview of your objective for the piece? And also, secondly, if an actor's giving too much spin to their character, how do you guide them and direct them?
That's a good question.
Ouch. Yes. Well, first of all, as a perverse person, I don't have a read-through. The read-throughs are really for the benefits of the executives. So I say, sorry, no. But I do rehearse. I rehearse pretty much every scene in the show. But I do it like this, round a table, just reading. So we talk about the themes and mostly the character motivations in those sessions in almost ludicrous depth, really. I write backstories for the characters, documents where I say what has happened to the characters in the past and give those to the actors, those kinds of things.
Hey, over here.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for your talk today. And in support of public sector broadcast, can I also direct people to This Cultural Life, your edition of that, which I thought was absolutely superb.
Thank you.
I'm also a complete Mark Rylance worshipper. And I think probably the risk of making you very big-headed is perhaps his two best bits of work are The Government Inspector and Wolf Hall. So do you, as collaborators, have you got another project in mind? That's a very closed question, I realise. And if not, can you fantasize for us and come up with a contemporary figure or historical figure that you would like to see Mark Rylance play under your direction?
What an extraordinary question.
Brilliant.
Well, Mark, as you know, I've worked with Mark 4 times. And since he's not here, I can say, I think he is the greatest actor we have at the moment working. Sorry to all the other actors I've worked with, but I really do think so. He's capable of. I mean, just think about it for a minute. Mark Rylance's probably the most famous performances in the Jez Butterworth play Jerusalem. Yeah. Now, anyone who's seen it, and many people probably have, because he's done it 3 or 4 times, he plays a character called Rooster, who's a sort of big, noisy, in-your-face, aggressive, crude, charismatic character. And Mark Rylance can dominate the stage like no one else. I don't know how many Tony Awards he's won, 2 or 3, I think. And yet, on camera, he's absolutely minute. And a slightly self-serving remark, but I will tell you this since you've been so kind. He hadn't done a lot of film work when I started working with him on The Government Inspector. And he has said publicly, so I can repeat it, that the thing he learned from me was to think. He, like a lot of actors, he just kept doing. And I said, look, the camera's in there. if the thought's right in your head, we will see it. You don't need to do anything. Just think it. But the thinking process has to be real. You can't think, I'm thinking about slamming that door now. It will therefore appear in my eyes. Slam that door. You have to be in the moment, for real. As David Kelly would have been, what was going through Kelly's mind in that moment? It has to be real. And then it'll look real. And the audience will look into his eyes, because this is what we do as human beings. And they will see what he's thinking. And of course, you know, I gave him that one little sentence and he took it and ran with it. And look at the result. It's breathtaking.
And do you have a fantasy role for him?
I think Mark Rylance should be the next James Bond.
Brilliant answer.
What's the problem?
We have a question over there.
Okay. How much has the change of technology able to bring atmosphere to Wolf Hall, like being able to use real candlelight rather than the horrible blue filters we had in the 80s for nighttime? Because it made it a lot more atmospheric, I felt, and allowed you to travel back further in time.
See, some of my colleagues, in fact, some very respected colleagues of mine, mentioning no names, talk about the good old days of film and cutting on film and shooting. I don't go with that at all. I love the new technology. It enables us to do things that we could only have dreamt of in the past. And I think in Barry Lyndon, they tried to shoot genuinely by candlelight, but they had these massive double wick candles because there wasn't enough light. So you had double wick candles which smoked like hell. And, you know, it did create an interesting effect. I'm lucky enough to work in the era when cameras are fast enough or lenses are fast enough to be able to shoot in the light of one candle. Now, the Daily Mail beat me up for this quite a lot on the first series, but I'm pretty proud of it. I'm very proud of Gavin Finney, the DOP, who figured out how to do it.
I think we are being urged to now. I think we're coming towards the end of our time. So I would like to say that it has been an utter privilege to talk with you and to think with you about your work. But I'm going to now hand over.
Thanks, Claire.